another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter.
Hi, this is Jack Spierko. Welcome to today's episode of the Survival Podcast. Today's subject that we're going to talk about is the total national debt and the real risk that it poses to all Americans and, in fact, the American way of life. If you hear some background noise, if you hear me occasionally yell at somebody, or you hear a pause, maybe that's me having a sip of coffee, but in general, most of the distractions you'll hear are due to the fact that this podcast, as always, is being recorded during a 50-mile morning commute. And with that said, I am doing my best to improve the quality of the audio, and should we be able to actually keep the website up anytime soon and get over our DNS problems with moving one server to another, maybe we'll go ahead and start working on improving the quality of this audio. I have some plans to be able to do a little bit better with that, but trying to keep the podcast solvent and out of the debt that is cancerously eating at our nation. The main subject I'm going to talk about today is our total public debt. And I won't get too much into the debt that's off the record. I'll talk about it a little bit at the end to show you how bad everything really is. But what I mean by public debt is the official books kept by our own federal government that says this is how much we owe collectively as a nation, how much the federal government itself owes, the state governments are owed, from the federal government, the state governments owe to each other, and the state governments owe to foreign interest, how much we as a people owe in household debt, our mortgages, our cars, our credit cards, all of that debt combined, how much the business sector owes. So how much all the companies out there owe that are doing business, and where that money is coming from, and how much the financial sector owes as well, things like just for instance, things like Freddie Mac that provides the FHA loans to our people to buy houses with. All of that debt put together, and the little other category called extra foreign debt that we'll talk about right at the end. So what does all this add up to? Right now, at least officially, it adds up to $53 trillion. I'll say that again, $53 trillion. Again, this is the acknowledged public debt on the balance sheets. This is not taking into account, you know, the errors that are probably made, the omissions that are willfully and accidentally made, and doesn't take into account things like Social Security Trust Fund, Medicaid, Medicare Trust Fund, and the emergency fund. Like, you know, that little $83 billion that was spent to fund the initial cost of the Iraq War? Yeah, it came out of the emergency fund, so it doesn't go on these books. So that's important to understand that there are three sets of books, and I'm only going with the total federal public books balance sheet. And I've got this information from a place called Grandfather Report, Grandfather Financial Reports. It is the most extensive breakdown I've ever seen that makes these numbers real and understandable to the average person. And because the guy's using kind of a subdomain, and this actual report's like several layers deep in his site, I'm not even going to try to give the link out in the podcast. But if you go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and look at this episode's blog entry, there'll be a link directly to this guy's reports and to his main website as well. And I encourage you to take a look at that. So let's start going through the breakdown and understanding exactly, you know, what kind of debt we have and what this really means. Well, this $53 trillion, if we break that up and say, well, how much does everybody owe, every man, woman, and child, including the babies that are being born right now as we speak that have no money, including the poor people that have no money, including the working poor that have no money, including the middle class that have income but no money because they've spent it all and they are in debt. And we just said if everybody had to pull their cash and let's pay this thing off right now, from business owners down to the poorest among us, we all owe collectively $174,000 apiece. Okay? That means if you have a spouse, the two of you together owe $174,000 times two, and if you have three kids, you owe $174,000 times five. Do you have $175,000 times five if you have three kids? Probably not. That's my point. Money's not there. It doesn't exist in a way that ever makes it repayable on our current trends. let's go into a breakdown of where that debt is, and let's talk about why it matters. Because I think some places we look at it and go, well, that's debt, but I don't care. It doesn't affect me. Well, let's look at how each one of these does affect all of us. Let's start out with our household debt. Now, this is the debt that you and I are responsible for. The debt that's real, the debt that's against our houses, the debt that's against our cars, and most toxically, the debt that's against our credit cards. You know, that Sears credit card, the MasterCard, the JCPenney credit card, the Kohl's credit card, Joe Blow's Emporium credit card, and all those other little credit cards that add up with 20 and 30% interest rates on them. That debt. We owe collectively as a society $13.8 trillion that way. Of that, about $10 trillion we owe as mortgages and equity loans on our homes. That's the good side of the debt. The $10 trillion, if there is a good side, has it. The problem is that when we look at the total value of all the assets underlying that $10 trillion, we're looking at really about a half a trillion in real assets. And that ratio is the equity value to debt ratio of our real property. And basically what that's saying is we owe, you know, 10 times more than the property itself is worth. It's the worst condition we've ever been in the history of the world. And what we need to understand is that this problem gets worse as the value of real property declines. It's no secret, right, that the value of real estate prices over the last 10 years has been in a sharp decline. There are places where the real estate market had appreciated to a very large degree, such as the West Coast, the Northeast, the Florida coastline, things like that, where people thought they were just doing wonderful and they were making money after money after money as their value of their house kept going up. But unfortunately, most of these people continued to pull equity in the form of loans out of their homes. Now these homes have begun to decline in value. In other words, the house that had 20% appreciation over 3 years, each year, 60% total, guy pulled all the money out of the house. He went out and got equity loans. He started living high off the hog, off the value of his property. And then what happens is the value of the property starts to decline. And it goes down by 20% for 3 years. And these are real numbers. This stuff really happened. So now this guy's sitting on a house. He's got an $800,000 mortgage on it, and nobody anywhere will pay more than $450,000 for it, or maybe $550,000. One way or another, he's $300,000 to $400,000 upside down on his house. When we add that all up, we end up with people that are upside down about $9 trillion of the $10 trillion. And that is, you know, that, to be fair, that's also, you know, debt on, you know, second mortgages, vacation homes, and things like that. People say, well, if a guy loses his vacation home, does it really matter? Well, yeah, it matters, because look at what the damage to the housing sector has already done to the economy. So what happens is people go, well, if you know, if Joe and Jim can't pay for their house, Joe and Jim lose their house. As long as me, Tom, can pay for my house, I don't really care. Well, the problem is that eventually this formula catches up to Tom. Tom, who did the right thing. Tom, who bought his house with 10% down payment on a 30-year fixed mortgage and negotiated well and had a little bit of equity the day he started out. He's been paying his bills on time every day for 5 years, and he should have a decent little equity stash in his house. If nothing else, he should be able to sell it and kind of get on down his merry way if he wants out of his house. Problem is, sooner or later, this formula catches up to Tom. Tom can't sell his house either. And the largest piece of wealth that most people have in their lives is their home. As long as you don't want to move, I guess it doesn't really matter. But if the other parts of the economy start to crumble, and you can't make your house payment anymore, then you're trying to get rid of a house you can't sell. And every time that happens to one person, it aggravates the situation. If there's more inventory on the market, and it starts causing problems for the economy as a whole, because as the real estate market goes, so goes the rest of the economy. That's just phase one, and we haven't gotten to the other $3 trillion in that part of the balance sheet. That's the debt that we owe to things like our credit cards. Okay? And we owe that money to a lot of people, and people go, well, I owe the money to MasterCard. Well, which bank is backing your MasterCard? In many cases, it's a European bank, or it's an Asian bank. So a lot of that money is actually foreign debt that we owe overseas. And if you ask all the people that are owed this money collectively, how much of this money have you already written off? They'll tell you that they've already written off $1 trillion in what they consider toxic U.S. consumer debt. And that means they're already saying, you know what, there's $1 trillion of this money we're never going to get back. Doesn't mean we're going to forget about it. Doesn't mean we're not going to hold it against you. It's just we know you can't pay it. Now, realize that that's not a good number for them, and they're not real happy about it. And what that means is nobody's trumping that number up. If anything, that number's being forced down. People are trying to keep their jobs collectively across all of these different financial institutions, and they're reporting. They're looking for ways to mitigate what are we going to have to write off. They don't want to put out a big number because their investors pull out. So that number's probably low. That's the acknowledged toxic consumer debt. So as a total, again, $13.8 trillion owed by the United States consumer, including his mortgage and his credit cards and all his other typical consumer-level debt. And just $1 trillion in unsecured credit card debt alone that can never be repaid, and a 10-to-1 reverse equity deficit against mortgages and real property. That's bad. That's bad enough to put the country in a deep trouble with just one or two hiccups if it was the only debt we had. Unfortunately, folks, it's a very small portion of the total debt that we have. Let's move on next to the federal debt. This is the debt that gets talked about a lot. This is the debt that our federal government owes. In other words, how much money they've borrowed just to run the country. Basic government programs, the basic government entitlements, everything that the government does to keep the lights on at the Capitol building, all the way down to making sure that somebody shows up for work every morning at, let's say, the FBI. And if we look at that number, it's $9 trillion. Let me say that again. That is $9 trillion. In other words, they're doing a better job than us as consumers. They owe $9 trillion, and we owe $13.8 trillion. The problem is that we, by and large, owe our money on something. Well, the federal government owes their money on nothing. There's no tangible asset underlying the federal debt. The only assets we have are ourselves. You know, Washington, D.C.'s monuments might be considered an asset. Maybe that can be seized by the Chinese guy that we owe a couple hundred million to that we can't pay back. I mean, that's as real as I can make it for you. That's as far as I can bring it down. The federal government doesn't hold much in assets. They certainly don't have $9 trillion in assets. So they owe more money than they have in assets. The only source of income they have is me and you, and we owe $13.8 trillion. You got to really start to think about that. Government is $9 trillion in debt. Their primary source of income is taxing the American people. The American people that pay them the taxes are themselves $13.8 trillion in debt. At least we, you know, forget the value of $1 million. $1 million is still a lot of money, and most people could take $1 million if they were smart about the way they structured it, could retire for the rest of their life on $1 million. Wouldn't that be great if you had $1 million? Well, how many millions of dollars does our government spend per hour to pay the interest on $9 trillion in debt? The answer, $49 million an hour. Just to pay the interest on the $9 trillion of debt that we hold. Just to pay the interest on that debt alone. Again, $49 million an hour. Now, want you to, again, it's hard to get your head around these giant, huge, enormous numbers. A trillion. Let's talk about a trillion for a second. I'm going to break this million thing down to you and make it personal at the end of this. A trillion is 1,000 billion. Okay? That's hard to get your head around. A billion is 1,000 million. Okay? Again, trillion, 1,000 billion, billion, 1,000 million. Okay? A lot of people are under the impression that if you have 100 million, you're kind of a billionaire. No, you're a tenth of a billionaire. So, here's how this works. You have to have 1,000 thousands, right? Right? Got that? 1,000 thousands to be a millionaire. Right? Once you're a millionaire, you have to do that again 1,000 more times to be a billionaire. And then if you were ever to be a trillionaire, and we don't have any trillionaires, you'd have to have $1,000 billion, right? And then you would have to do that 9 more times to create $9 trillion, which doesn't even exist in paper cash money anywhere in the world. Right? We took all the money from everybody. There isn't $9 trillion out there to pay this debt off with. Now, that $49 billion an hour to pay our debt. Do you know how many people we have in this country? It's roughly 300 million people. Right? We're burning, all right, $600 million a day in interest. If we took the interest that we pay on our debt and gave it to every man, woman, and child for one day, every American would receive a check for roughly $2 million. I gotta say this again, because you gotta understand this. $49 million a day in interest. 300 million people are paying that right now. If we distributed it to our people, and it's not practical, it's not an idea, all right? I don't think we should do this. It won't work. But if we did, $2 million per person, every man, woman, and child, would just receive that for the interest. That's how much money we squander. You got to get your head around that. Now, moving on from federal debt, what do our businesses owe? And again, a lot of this money, you got to understand, people go, well, if IBM goes broke, I don't care. I don't work for IBM. You probably hold a mutual fund that holds IBM stock. And if you don't, you're probably working for some company somewhere that's supplying some company somewhere that supplies IBM. And what I'm saying is, in America, all our businesses are related, and when a big company falls, or even a mid-sized company falls, it creates a chain reaction. Everybody that supplies those companies gets hurt. And when those companies get hurt, they cut their spending, and everybody that supplies them gets hurt. Right? So what does this add up to? Just a little number like $10 trillion. Our businesses as a whole owe over $10 trillion in debt right now in the United States. $10 trillion. All right, more than the federal government owes. Again, you and I and the businesses of America have outdebted, you know, the U.S. government. Again, though, at least the businesses have assets. You know, IBM has computers, they have buildings, they have things to back their debt to a degree. Nowhere near enough to cover it, but at least there's a tangible asset that can be seized. But that's not a good thing. Not for you, not for me. What happens is these companies are deeper and deeper in debt, they stop paying their bills. When they stop paying their bills, they start hurting the lending institutions that gave them money. We've seen a bank fail already, and we will probably see 4 to 5 more banks fail in the next 2 years. Now, these are projections that have been made by, you know, reputable sources, and they're not alarmist in nature. They're just the fact that these banks owe each other money, and when one of them falls, and all the money that they owed Bank B is gone, and Bank B can't come up with that money, they tend to have really difficult problems. So again, the business sector, $10 trillion. Now, financial sector, well, that accounts for another $15 trillion. Okay. Now, I don't even want to go deep into that because it starts to get laborious at this point. But now you have a kind of a breakdown of where this $53 trillion. Now, if you were sitting there writing all these numbers down and add them up, you'd be a little short right now. You go, hey, Jack, we're about $1.8 trillion short from your $53 trillion. Where's that other $1.8 trillion? You know, $1 trillion is real money. Kind of matters. Where's it at? Well, it's in a category called extra foreign debt. I don't even know what that means, other than we owe it to people that aren't here. We owe it to people who are overseas that may not really be real hip on us doing well. We owe it to others outside of our country. And we don't really even bother to account for exactly what it is. And it adds up to almost $2 trillion. I guarantee you that by the end of this year, it'll be over $2 trillion. You might as well call it $1.8, $2 trillion, because this stuff runs away. It's compounding, and it compounds against you. So, now, I remember being in school, and we used to talk about the debt in the 80s, and as Reagan was spending more and more money, and I was actually a pretty big fan of Ronald Reagan. And I still think he did a lot of things right, did a lot of things wrong, like every president we've had, at least in the past 100 years, by not following the Constitution of the United States. But, you know, kind of digressing from there, we were taught that, you know, that debt's not as bad as it sounds because we owe the money to ourselves. That a lot of that debt is U.S. savings bond, and most of the people that own U.S. savings bonds are U.S. citizens. And we're loaning our own government money, and this just shows confidence of the American citizen and the American government. And that's hope for the future, and it's a wonderful thing. Well, those would be lies today. Right now, if you just wanted to say, what portion of our debt comes from foreign sources, of our $53 trillion, $12.5 trillion. $12.5 trillion we owe to foreign government right now. Directly. There's an indirect foreign component in there that we don't understand, and no one's, as far as I know, yet really broke it down. In other words, when we look at our, you know, household debt, and we look at John's $15,000 that he owes to MasterCard, and can never pay, and he's not going to pay, and he's making minimal payments for the next year or two before he quits, and before the collection agencies come after him, and eventually they give up because he just doesn't have it. When he says he owes MasterCard $15,000, what bank is backing MasterCard? What bank backs that bank? In other words, part of that $15,000 John owes may be part of our foreign debt that's not even tracked. In fact, a great deal of it, I believe, is. So we've got all this foreign debt out there. And we've got all this consumer debt. And we've got all this federal debt. And then the financial sector owes trillions, and then the business sector owes trillions, and it all adds up to $53 trillion, and people go, man, that really sucks. Now, let me throw the icing on the cake here. You see, remember I told you in the beginning that there are two other books out there, and I do not have the numbers from one, I only have the numbers from the other. The books that I have the numbers from for you are the unfunded entitlements. All right, the other debt that no one talks about, the debt that equals the total debt I just broke down. When you add Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security up, we just happen to have unfunded obligations to them of around $51 trillion, almost equivalent to all our other debt combined. $51 trillion that we owe ourselves with money we don't have. Because what's been happening is this $53 trillion we've just broke down in very specific detail has been had its funding come from paying off its interest, keeping it going, keeping it floating, by robbing the Social Security and Medicare funds. Now, this is the infamous lockbox that Al Gore talked about, but the problem is there is no lockbox. There is no money. There's nothing there but an IOU from the federal government that's an IOU that's backed by nothing. There is no money there. It's gone. And we go, well, that doesn't even make sense. Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Except that it's true, and it's real, and there is no Social Security funds left. There's no money in there. There's just enough to kind of keep what we have going, and then take all the rest of the money and use it to pay all these other expenses that it's not supposed to be used for. And when we look forward into the future and go, what's this all going to cost? We're at a $50 trillion plus shortfall. Wow. $50 trillion shortfall. Holy crap. Another $50 trillion. Where the hell are we going to get that? The reality is we're not going to get it. So people go, well, you know, I have no Social Security. It's going to go broke for a long time. I mean, I'm not planning on getting no Social Security. I'm 35 years old. I'm saving my money. Well, the problem is that sooner or later this thing's going to hit. We're not going to be able to pay Social Security, and there's going to be some in-between generation. It's probably going to be part of the baby boomers that are not going to get their money. Sooner or later, someone's going to make the hard decision and say, you know what? We don't have money for this stuff anymore. We can't pay you. I don't care if we said we were going to. We don't have it. There isn't any more. No, you don't get paid. Now, what's going to happen then is all the people that are still working are going to go, well, we're not giving you our money for Social Security when you're killing the program. Because we know it's gone into oblivion and into nothingness. That's why some members of our government have started talking about privatizing some portion of the Social Security program. They're trying to prevent an out-and-out blood-in-the-streets revolution, folks. Because people won't sit for it. Now, if people start to build up a private portion of their Social Security funds today, and there's this kind of weaning off period where you guys, you're going to get all of your government promised money, this group here is going to get some, and then, you know, you're going to fall back, and then there's a fallback there, which is private, and the younger you are, The longer you're going to pay and not get anything back, but the bigger your private peace will be if that all works out, because remember, economies would be crap with this other $53 trillion we owe. But in theory, that would create kind of a softening of when we pull the plug on this thing, because it can't be funded anymore. The money's not there. Again, it's just not there. We don't have it. But if we get to a point where we just say, you know what, you're going to work, Joe, and we're going to jack up your Social Security just to pay Tom, who's 72 and retired, and we got to fulfill our obligation to Tom. And guess what? You're now paying 100% of Tom's Social Security. You have your own single individual assigned old person that you're taking care of. Pretty soon, the American workers are going to go, I'm not doing this, and there's going to be a revolt. Now, that's just the beginning of our problems. Now we really have to understand how the weakening dollar and the artificial inflation of the number of dollars in the market affect everything. Everybody sound confused? I'm going to try to make this real simple. All right? Let's start with the artificial inflation of the number of dollars out there, because it's directly tied to the decrease in the value of the dollar. You have to start thinking about your $1 bill with George Washington on it like a stock certificate in the United States. That $1 bill long ago said our federal government has at least a dollar's worth of gold in the treasury, and if you bring it into some place, they will give you a dollar's worth of gold in return for it. That's what it used to mean. We went off the gold standard long ago. The last vestiges of it were destroyed by Richard Nixon. And there wasn't much of it left, honestly, when he did it. It was pretty much dead by the time we went into World War II. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. The good part of this is it enabled us to produce money, control the value of our money to a large degree for a long time, and it enabled us to not go through shortfalls in hard currency. Because let's say around 1880, when most of the United States were farmers, farmers would need to borrow money in the spring, and then they would pay off their debt when the harvest came in the fall. Sounds like a good system. The problem was there was a finite number of dollars. Since the U.S. could only print a dollar if it had a dollar's worth of gold, eventually you get to a point where the banks would just go, we don't have any more money. And they go, how do you not have money? You're the bank. And the bank would go, well, we have assets, but we don't have any more cash. I don't have the money to issue to you. So the Federal Reserve was created in one vein, was designed to take care of this. And it did fix that problem. It was actually quite subversive, and we're not going to go down that rat hole today, but just think about it that way for now. Well, the problem is that once that happens, basically you've now given away the ability to print money at will and loan it to our people, to private banks. The Federal Reserve is not owned by the federal government. It is a group of private banks that print, own, and control our money supply. So what happens when the government just can't pay a bill? There's just not enough money there. Well, we just dump more money into the economy. We fire up the presses and we print more money. We issue more dollars. This seems like, well, that's kind of like can go on forever, right? Wrong. Because the way that this started out was, people looked around and went, you know what? The value of our nation isn't just the gold we have buried in a hole in the ground. The value of our nation is we produce food. We produce stuff. This Federal Reserve System will let us take that value and apply it to our economy. So we were issuing money against our productivity. As long as that stayed in balance, things worked out pretty well. The problem is that we have very low productivity today. Our society has become a society based on pleasure, cheap imported goods, and laying around and doing as little as possible for as much as we can get by doing it. I'm not coming down on the American people as a whole here, but the reality is, as a nation, we just don't produce what we used to produce. We don't export what we used to export. So this money value against the world economy is being based on less and less productivity. What that means is when the federal government, or the Federal Reserve, pushes more money into the economy, the value of each dollar has to go down. This is like a stock split, okay? You own 1,000 shares of Exxon at $150 a share, and Exxon says, hey, you know what? No one's going to touch our stock at $150 a share. So what they do is they cut the value of the stock from $150 down to $75, but they double the number of stock shares out there. Now, it doesn't hurt you in the stock market. It's usually good for you. Because you just went from owning 1,000 shares at $170 or $150 a share to owning 2,000 shares at $75 a share. You have the same amount of money. Your equity was protected. But what if Exxon said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to cut the value of our shares to $75. We're going to double the stock, but we're not going to give stock to the people that already own it. We're just, you're now going to own 1,000 shares of $75. You just had the value of your stock cut in half. Now, if you'd like to go buy some more, you can. That's how the money works. They double the money supply. The value of your dollar goes to 50 cents. If you want to get your value back, you have to go work or produce double the money you already have to get back to square one. Because there's no intrinsic value there. All right? We keep doing this and the dollar keeps declining. You know, go to Google, search for the value of a dollar, the value of the U.S. dollar, something like that, and pull up images and look for a graph. It'll scare the hell out of you. That's our stock price in the world economy. And it's been dropping like a rock for the last several years. And I mean like a rock. So how does this affect everything? Well, this all works together. Why are we paying too much for gas? We're paying too much for gas, supply and demand, oil, China, India, blah, blah, blah. Hey, a big part of why we're paying more money for gas is because the value of the dollar keeps going down. And when all these countries are pumping oil out of the ground and they're selling it on the market and our dollar buys less, they're not willing to drop the price of oil to meet our drop in the dollar price. So that's a big part of the issue here. It's not just that the oil is going up, but our ability, our purchasing power against the world market is going down. All of these things compound together. So, you know, I hope this wasn't a gloom and doom podcast for you. I just want to make you aware of the real risk that's out there. Because if any one of these sectors fails, they are all interconnected. The housing sector has not failed. All these bad mortgages and the depression in the market, you know what? You can still sell a house today. You can still buy a house today. We've only had a minor impact, less than 5% of properties are even affected in any way, shape, or form directly, as in people losing them or mortgages not being paid, right? What if it's 10%, 15%? How does that interact with everything else? So the solution here is simple. And I'm going to close with the solution, but I'm going to explain to you why the solution is bad for everyone that doesn't follow the solution and how the solution is probably inevitable as well. First, the solution is, no surprise, get out of debt, stay out of debt. Second, minimize the amount of money that you have invested into the vulnerable U.S. stock market, and it's extremely vulnerable right now. Number three, cut your personal spending. Cut it way back. Number four, become more self-sufficient. The motto of the survivalist, grow some of your own food, learn how to repair things, learn how to do more with less, right? That's a great solution for you. It's a terrible solution for the economy, short term. And what's going to happen is more and more people are figuring this stuff out. More and more people realize that they owe money in the debt too. That they are contributing to it, that they need to fix it, that they need to cut their spending, they need to get rid of their credit cards, they need to pay off their loans, they need to pay off first everything but their house, and then they need to figure out how to pay off their house. They need to sell that big house and buy a smaller house. They need to sell that expensive car and buy a more fuel-efficient car. They need to do whatever it takes to get their act together, so to speak, financially. So what happens when the majority, not even the majority, let's say when 10% of the hamsters running in the wheel right now get off that wheel, stop digging themselves deeper and deeper in debt, and stop spending money. The entire economy falters. This is like, you see this in the medical field. Somebody has a fungal infection that's causing them illness, and the doctor prescribes an antifungal. When that fungus gets attacked, it rages, and the patient gets worse before they get better. And then once it starts to kill off the fungus, everything gets better. In a human being, this is a relatively short time period. A long-term cycle might be 30 days. Most of the time, you're talking maybe a week, and you've gone through the whole thing. The economy is going to be a much longer process. You've got to look at, for every day we got into it, we're going to need probably a day to get out of it. We've been getting into it for 40 years. So what happens is our entire economy is based on spending. If you look around, all these businesses you see, all this booming business that's still going on, is based on people spending money. That's why people freak out whenever the numbers for Christmas are profitable, but not as big as they were the year before. That's why the government spent billions that it didn't have to give every American between $300 and $1,200 to spend with this economic stimulus package. If the money in the economy makes the economy work. But the American people are getting tired of it. We are funding it with our own debt. We're letting our government go into debt, but we've gone into debt. We've gone into debt as business owners and entrepreneurs. We've gone into debt as consumers. And we've gone into debt heavily as homeowners. And that debt has funded the economy. And what I'm saying is people like you are becoming more and more prevalent. People that listen to things like this podcast, people that do this research, people that understand these things are becoming more and more the norm, the reality. And as that happens, they're pulling their spending back. They're removing their own debt. They're getting out of the system. But the majority of people are going to stay in the system. And there's a tipping point when enough of us stop spending to adversely affect the economy and leave those behind, left behind, and struggling with the debt that they have. And being in a position where when the economy fails, they can't afford the cost of living, and then they don't pay their debt. Then the debts go unpaid, and then foreclosures, if you want to call them that, start to happen on a massive level. And remember that about 25% of those foreclosures could come from foreign governments seizing our assets, either as individuals or as a society. If that doesn't scare you, I mean, something's wrong with you. You don't have enough blood pumping through your system right now. So, again, that's your solution. Just understand that your solution is going to be part of everybody else's problem. That if 15% of the people in the United States follow common sense, I'm going to get out of debt, stay out of debt, and reduce my spending, and I'm going to buy used cars, and I'm going to, you know, stay off of the treadmill, stay out of the hamster wheel, it would grind our economy to a halt. That's why our government doesn't want you to do it. That's why they keep figuring out ways to give us more money. That's why they keep cutting interest rates. That's why they keep issuing more money. They don't want it to happen. But it has to happen. We can't go on forever borrowing money. We can't keep robbing Peter to pay Paul. Sooner or later, you know, Peter's going to say, hey, you can't have any more money. You know, and I'll close with a thought. There was a story back in the 80s of this guy that got every credit card he could get his hands on. He put them in a box, and he had a filing system. And he would use card A to pay card B, and then he would say, well, I paid card B, so he'd go apply for card C. Card C would give him a card because he proved he makes payments, so he'd borrow from card C and pay card B. And he kept doing this, and he kept getting more and more credit, and deeper into debt, but he had everybody paying everybody else off. He had a self-replicating, or self-reciprocating system that allowed for him to keep spending more money, living a high life, and had his credit looking great because he always paid his bills on time. Well, his house of cards fell down. He was able to do this for about 2 years, which is pretty impressive. But the point is that, you know, he had a little microcosm and it took 2 years to fall apart. We have this huge mega behemoth of an economy that we've been raping for 40 years. And sooner or later, our house of cards is going to have to fall too. And remember, that's what we're here to help you do, is figure out how to live the kind of life you want to live. Even if this monstrosity continues for another 20 years, how to live those 20 years in kind of a good life, a self-sufficient life, an independent life, a life where you don't owe the company store, so to speak, which ends up being our federal government. And if things do go wrong, to be one of the people that not just survives, but thrives.
Another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.